Welcome, everybody. This is the IMDA's Founders Series. My name is Ian Charles Stewart. I'm an executive in residence here at IMD. And I'm joined today by Raffaella D'Andrea, who is, apart from being a professor at ETH, which is probably the leading tech university in Switzerland, he's also the co-founder of warehouse systems company Kiva Systems, which eventually became Amazon Robotics, because Amazon bought it from him for lots of money, which is always a good thing. He's now currently still a professor at ETH and working on another startup. One of the things we'll ask him is how many he hasn't sold for $775 million, but Verity seems to be doing very interesting things and is a natural progression on, from what I understand, from what you guys were doing at Kiva. The Founder Series interviews started originally live and then, of course, through COVID, switched to being virtual in this manner. The origin of this series, it's part of the Alumni Center for Entrepreneurship at IMD, and it's part of our effort to expose a group of alumni who've been asking for access to stories by entrepreneurs, for entrepreneurs, about entrepreneurs, partly because some of these people want to try building companies themselves and others because they wish to invest in them. There's quite an enthusiastic angel investor community around the school. And so we try to provide conversations with people who've done really interesting things in really interesting ways. And so our chat today will be partly about what Raff has done with his two companies, partly about why he's doing what he was doing, a little bit about how, and then a little bit about what he thinks the implications are for the broader community from the automation, AI, robotics work that he does. We generally focus on companies that are disrupting existing industries, and we spend as much time trying to understand what might be disrupted as what is actually being disrupted. We do a little bit of future think in the process, although, as Raff was telling me earlier, speculation is not one of his favorite things. He'd rather make something that actually works, which I have to say I applaud. So, Raff, welcome to IMD.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Verity and how it differs from what you guys did at Kiva Systems.
At Verity, we're not moving things. You know, at Kiva, we developed a system that for distribution that moved goods around in warehouses. And at Verity, we've created systems that collect data when you need it, where you need it. So it's all about collecting information and making it available to higher level systems, clients, warehouse management system, so that, you know, you can make better decisions.
And Kiva, I remember looking at the videos, very cool, was about, as you say, moving things around on pallets with control systems underneath them, following barcodes in the floor with monitoring around them. Verity is actually like going into an ovarium because there are drones flying in different places, stopping in front of pallets and in front of blocks at quite high levels in places, doing inventory management and also helping understand how better to optimize a warehouse system. Is it something like that?
We have a system that, from a technical perspective, it allows us to collect data when you need it, where you need it, and what powers it are self-flying drones. So these are fully autonomous drones, takeoff, landing, charging, obstacle avoidance, obstacle detection. They can fly anywhere in these very large warehouses. We're in talks with one of our clients to install in a warehouse that's 200,000 square meters. I mean, that's huge, 2 million square feet. Some of them are at heights now of 15 to 18 meters. So these very huge warehouses, basically they're flying mobile phones. I mean, they can go anywhere in space and collect data. Right now they're collecting image data, depth information. They also have environmental sensors, temperature and humidity, but really there's no limit to the kind of information that they can sense and collect.
So I guess one of the limits you do have is that you're in a closed, enclosed system, right? I know that for the original Kiva Systems applications, the system was shielded off from the workers so that they were in a confined space and they worked within their area. The same is true to a degree with the drones. It works because you have sensors everywhere, because you have a controlled space, and because there's nothing extraneous that might come in and interfere with it. Although you do have object avoidance, so that's partly the drones avoiding themselves. So how much is it controlled and how much is it possible to do it in an open system?
So first of all, with Kiva, Kiva didn't have sensors looking at Kiva. Kiva, everything was self-contained on the drones,
right,
on the robots.
Yeah.
I mean, those were just used for navigation. But the reason that people were not allowed in the space is because we wanted to think of this as a machine. You know, the robots, they were moving very, very fast, shuttling things around. And then they would bring the goods to the perimeter of the warehouse where people didn't need to go inside the space. With our system right now, the drones are actually pretty small. You know, they're about this big, fit in your hand. They're about a kilo. They can easily coexist with people if you wanted them to. The part that it's hard to coexist with are forklifts, because forklifts can move extremely fast, 35 kilometers an hour.
Right.
They have very poor situational awareness, and you can only get out of the way fast enough if a forklift comes barreling around. But the drones are fully, they navigate. All the ability to navigate is inside the drone. There's no external cameras looking at the system or anything like that.
And actually, what you just described is part of the problem that people are saying we have with autonomous vehicles out in the open space, which is the high variability of what might turn up at different speeds from different angles at different times.
That's correct. And there's lighting conditions outdoors. Right. We created a system where we can actually fly in complete darkness. Car at night has lights, so we can see where it's going. Our drones are similar. They have, you know, you can't see them when they fly at night, but they can collect all the data. They can do all this work at night. They tend to work at night when there's no one around. Okay. But the coexistence part, it's really about things like forklifts.
Sure. So does that mean that no one is using both Kiva Systems and Verity drones in the same factory yet?
No, I mean, we just launched, Verity. We created the company in 2014. We're a deep tech company. We created something that doesn't exist, the ability to fly drones autonomously indoors when there's no GPS reliably. You know, that took a lot of effort to be able to do. So we launched the product in 2021. We are operating in 12 countries. We're doing more than 1 million inventory checks per month. Wow. We're flying hundreds of kilometers on a regular basis. But right now, there's no coexistence of Kiva with Verity.
I highly recommend that people search on YouTube for RAF and Kiva and Verity. It's great fun to see the videos. It's really quite impressive to see how effective they are and how efficient they are. A slightly different question in comparing the two companies. Kiva was founded what year?
2003.
And you sold it?
2012.
Okay, so a good 9 years. And lots of things have changed during that period, technology capability, but also management and the things you've done and the things you've learned. Are you building Verity any differently from the way you built Kiva?
Yes, for, I would say, three reasons. First of all, when you do something once, you learn how to improve it. You try to do it better. Take the things that you learn from doing that and apply it differently. The second one is, you said it already, things have changed from a technological perspective. So, you know, we are a deep tech company, so there are different capabilities that you can bring to bear. And I think the third is that Kiva, I was actually the tech guy, you know, and Mick was the business guy. And at Verity, I'm more the business guy, even though I was very involved technically at first, but we have an amazing CTO and he's one of the co-founders, Marcus Henn. So I really focused more on running the company. So that's different, very different.
I can imagine, having done the latter and not the former, I can imagine. So let me ask you a question which came to mind when I saw that you were both a professor actively at ETH and now CEO of a really interesting high-tech startup already generating revenues and trying to raise more money. One of the things that when I was running money as a venture capitalist, either Lazard or at Rothschild, one of the things we tried to make sure of was that whoever was there was committed 100% full-time to the project. You spend some of your time as a professor, where I can imagine there's a lot of value being made in the research, but that means that time is taken away from you at the company. How do you manage that conversation with potential investors?
Well, first of all, I was on leave for a significant amount of time to get Verity off the ground. We're 120 people right now, so we've really scaled up. We have an amazing management team of 10 folks that run the company. We like to empower people.
Yeah.
And I keep those two things very separate. You know, what I do at ETH as a professor is very different than what I do as a CEO. And I think those two things complement each other mentally. It's wonderful to be able to do one thing. And then it just helps you in ways that it's hard to quantify, but just thinking very differently about things helps both significantly. So I think I understand why, when the company's in its infancy, why you want that commitment. But I actually think that the way it's working right now, because of, you know, I teach two of the most popular courses in the graduate program in robotic system control at ETH. 200 students, they come to my lectures, they find out what I'm doing, and they get interested in my company, so they apply to it. So it's one way to explain it to folks. But let's put Twitter aside. I think Elon Musk has done okay running multiple companies.
No, I agree. I spend part of my time here helping out in the MBA program. And apart from trying to enthuse and inspire people to do things and stretch themselves and try for things that they might not normally think about, whilst I also spend my time with my companies, I've also found myself hiring some of the students that I like, which has been a great benefit.
It helps. But I think at the end of the day, it's really about empowering people in the company, especially as the company grows. You really want to make sure that, you know, the folks that are, you know, on fire, just give them as much responsibility as they can absorb and let them hire people too. You know, they should be doing the same. I have a general philosophy in life is that I try to make myself obsolete in absolutely everything I do.
Yeah.
Except parenting.
Good philosophy, I think, on both counts. Parenting, if people haven't tried it, is one of the toughest things to do and one of the most fulfilling. So over that period of time, two companies we've talked about, can we just back out a little bit?
Sure.
Are these the only two companies you started? Because you're hitting 100% at the moment, if that's the case.
I also helped a company, RoboGlobal, get off the ground. It's a company that introduced the world's first robotics ETF. Of course, the markets have changed the last little bit, but certainly above $2 billion in assets under management. And we did that in 2013, kind of really before anyone really was thinking about, you know, thematic investments in the robotics and automation space, very much overlooked by Wall Street and Main Street.
Yeah,
you know, it's doing well. Obviously, the last little bit has taken a toll, just like anything related to tech, but the fundamentals are super strong.
Anything related to tech with long time horizons for payback. The big tech companies like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Apple, because they're also big revenue generators and big profit generators, Amazon aside, they're doing less poorly. But the ones that have long time horizons for revenue, raising interest rates simply increases the discount factor, which therefore reduces the value. And that's why they've been
hit. That's correct. Yeah. Although like Amazon has gone down by a factor of two, I think. I think they're below 1 trillion. And, you know, Facebook, of course, has taken a huge dive.
Right. But even Facebook, it's 70% versus 95%. The differentials are quite interesting. I think I spent most of my time trying to help the companies that I get involved with. So investment return is never a decision for me. It's never a factor in the work I do with companies.
So. Yeah. I mean, with small companies, I've actually been very successful investing. But I mean, investing in the markets, like I'm a macro investor.
Right. Me too.
So, and I always seem to be looking at things and it always takes much longer than like anticipated. Like in 2002, my wife wanted to buy a house. Right. And I said, we're not buying a house right now. Like, this is going to be a big disaster. Right.
And took 20 years for that to sort out.
Well, it took, you know, like 7 years, right? 2008, the housing bubble. So it's like, you know, anyway.
Back to the companies again. We often talk about the processes that are involved. And I don't want to get too involved in management processes per se. But what have you found this time around surprisingly easy? And what have you found surprisingly difficult? What's different in the current environment that you have in trying to build and put together Verity?
So what I found easy, relatively speaking, is just having access to some amazing talent here in Switzerland. Mm. You know, ETH is the number one ranked technical school, not in Switzerland, but in Europe, right? Mm-hmm. It's the number one technical school in Europe. It's ranked top 10 globally. It's just an amazing amount of talent. Robotics systems and control is extremely strong. It's one of the best places to do it is here in Switzerland. So getting amazing top talent has been easier than it was in the United States. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would posit that back in 2003, and I think it's much easier than now, where everyone tries to be in Boston or Silicon Valley or, you know, Austin, the new Silicon Valley. And then now there's North Carolina, the new Austin. I mean, there's just, it's always super, super competitive. So I think that's where it's been easier. Harder, I think, is getting capital here is relatively straightforward for seed companies.
Yeah.
I think it's relatively straightforward when you are making money and you just need to scale, but very low risk. I think that there's kind of this valley in between, which was hard when we started Verity in 2014. But the general trajectory is that is getting better, but it's still harder than it is in the United States.
Yeah, no, I've heard that several times. The valley of death, people call it here. The gap between startup phase and then scale up phase.
Yeah.
And you're right. If you have revenues and profits, then scaling up, people will happily give you the money for
That's
it.
That's right.
But if you're in that stage where you're still trying to build as fast as you can and as hard as you can,
exactly,
it's a little bit harder. I mean, it also varies by sector. This is a country that
That's
supports
right.
medtech and
exactly.
biotech and pharma really easily.
Right.
But there's a lot of stuff. And I particularly do B2C tech and consumer. There's nothing here. There's neither funds nor are there many startups. And I find myself traveling a lot just to be able to go back to play with the sectors that I
Yeah, have. I was going to say the exception to that, of course, is crypto. You know,
crypto's become big here. I think there are really interesting things going on. I think I like a lot of the thinking behind the development. I just think there's not enough understanding of traditional finance working into the crypto finance space. And I think the whole space would be stronger if we had a better blend of risk management in the area.
I have a philosophical aversion to it. I believe that the world should be, the underlying social glue should be trust.
Right.
A deal should mainly be shake of a hand. Right. And then, of course, you got to get the documents, dot the I's and cross the T's, right? The whole premise behind crypto is that there
no
need for trust.
Right.
And to me, it's a philosophical point that I have with crypto as opposed to anything else.
That's very interesting. I really like that as an angle. One of the things that I think you've talked about on a number of talks, getting back to the companies and the business, and more specifically, the solutions you're working on, is how you're working on complete systems. They're not discrete items. It's not robots per se. It's not drones per se. You're creating systems. How far can those systems go? How big can they get? And do the systems have to have walls? It's a similar question to one I asked earlier, is how far out can you go on these things? How far can the autonomous nature of a system spread out beyond the limits of a warehouse?
Yeah. So for what we're doing at Verity, these are self-flying drones. We've designed them to fly specifically indoors where there is no GPS. right? And the reason we chose to do that is that there's a lot of activity that happens indoors. There's a lot of problems that people have indoors. Because we are operating indoors, it means from a technological perspective, it's actually harder to do because there is no GPS. So there's a technical hurdle to doing things indoors.
It's different. You've got variability in GPS, which of course is a pain if you're trying to do something accurately.
Sure, right? But you can fly relatively accurately with GPS, you know, meter, and then you augment it with information. So you can know roughly where you are pretty accurately. Whereas if you want to fly indoors, you don't have that. You have to develop other ways of doing that. So it is more difficult in that way. But it's easier in the sense that you don't have to deal with rain, wind. So that means that you can make your platform much, much smaller, right, which has this huge advantage when it comes to collecting data, because then the operational costs become very, very small. Think of a camera. The camera on your phone weighs 1 gram. The CCD weighs 1 gram. And think of how they do inventory right now. They have a scissors lift and a person that goes up top. You've got like 150, 200 kilos of stuff to put a 1 gram CCD in the right spot at the right place. It makes no sense from that perspective. So you really want these platforms, these mobile sensing platforms, to be as small as possible. And you can do that when you're flying indoors.
And actually, I think you've said it various times that although people focus on the robots and they focus on the drones, if they look at what you've done, you've said several times, it's more about the algorithms and the software that you're developing to try and manage everything and to allow the individual units to manage themselves rather than the physical.
It's the whole system, right? So there's no doubt that the drones we make from a physical perspective are actually extremely well designed. They have, you know, we have some design patents on them, but it's really all the algorithms that run on the drones that really make them magical, you know, the ability to navigate indoors. And so part of it is figuring out how to design this thing so that you can give enough sense data to the drone or robot or whatever to figure out where it is and do its job. So it's the whole design aspect of it is important. All the algorithms, you know, we design the full stack. We don't buy consumer drones and put them in a warehouse. We design everything from the ground up, which is why we can operate in multiple countries. Systems are flying every night and we go to sleep comfortably because we know that our system works.
Unless people think he's exaggerating, he was inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame with his team a couple of years ago. That must have been cool.
Yeah, that was fun. It was in Washington with Mick and Pete. It was cool to see our robots in Washington, and it's a big honor.
Which means the rest of the industry also considers what you're doing cool. So it wasn't just the fact that you guys did something that solved a problem, it was something that nobody else was doing. So very cool.
Yeah, we solved a very difficult technical problem. These Amazon warehouses now have upwards of 4,000 of these mobile robots running around fully autonomously, no human intervention. That and you know, they just do it day in and day out, and that takes, you know, a certain amount of, you know, effort to be able to do.
Very cool. Okay, so let's shift gear a little bit now from talking about the company and the cool stuff you've been doing within the company to other things which spread a little bit further beyond warehouse systems. And think about, I've had emails and WhatsApp messages asking us to ask questions about what they can expect to see in their lives, what they expect to see in the future. And I know you don't like speculation, but we'll try a little bit. First thing, we had an early conversation a little while ago and you railed against robotics as a service. Tell me what you mean by that and tell me why you're railing against it.
So there's a right time to do it and then there's the wrong time to do it as a company journey. So first of all, let's think about it as, what does it mean when you're doing it as a service? Why would you do it as a service? At the end of the day, you're a company, you're doing this as a service because the company at the other end either can't afford to buy it, or the things are constantly changing and they don't want to commit to it, or they want the flexibility. You know, there's many reasons why, but at the end of the day, someone, you're just shifting the risk around, right? And, you know, you hear stories of, well, also the other reason you want to do it as a service is as a recipient, you know, you want to be able to scale up during peak and scale down and you do it as a service. Well, the problem with that argument is that everybody tends to scale up and down at the same time. Right. So, Kim, it's a vacuous argument. So what it really boils down to is the cost of capital. To me, that's a big part of it. And a startup company, its cost of capital is going to be way higher than an established company that you're selling something to. So from a pure cost of capital perspective, I don't see why it makes sense from a macro perspective, why a company like ABB or IKEA, one of our clients, would want to pay less upfront and pay something as a service when they would rather just put more money upfront and lower their amount of annual service. And from our perspective, as a company that's growing at 3x every year, I want to pull in as much money now as opposed to saying, no, it's okay, I want a revenue stream over the long period. Well, when you're growing at 3x, the amount of installations, you know, new clients that you sign up, in any 1 year will be double. You can do the math. It's simple. Double everything that has summed up to that point in time. So you really want to upfront that amount of capital as much as possible.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. I think scale-ups, people don't realize how capital intensive it is and how much front-end money you need to have.
That's correct.
I think the argument for an environment where the technology is rapidly changing is one where the argument's harder to make. I think from a small company trying to sell to a large company, of course, you want to sell a complete system and make money. But the large company, if they're looking at the technology and it's at a stage where it's clearly in flux, and it's hard to commit the capital. One solution to that, of course, is to try and build in upgrades into the system.
That's right.
And I guess you guys do that, right?
Absolutely.
If you have a system, you can tell them, we will future-proof you for at least the next 5 years based on our ability to be able to change either chips or algorithm or firmware or something.
Right. I mean, for Verity, it's clear, right? We've done two things for our clients. For them, it's just one because they don't care how you slice it, right? They just, is this providing value? But the first layer is the ability